I'm Levy Dalton, and this is I'll Drink to That, a bi-weekly program where we get behind the scenes in the wine business. The exclusive sponsor of I'll Drink to That is 750, a powerful and easy-to-use online search tool for wholesale buyers of wine and spirits in New York and New Jersey. 750 incorporates over 80 distributor portfolios and a number of unique features that make the lives of buyers simpler and more productive. Emanuela Stucchi Prinetti on the show today from Badia a Cotabono in Tuscany. Hello and welcome.
Hello. Thank you very much.
Thank you
for being here.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about the history of Badia a Cotabono, as we know?
You know, a little bit is a hard question because the history of Badia a Cotabono is so long, but it has started as a monastery. Badia really means abbey, monastery. And it was founded just before the year 1000. So Badia a Coltibuono, the abbey of good harvest, of good crop, has a history in the winemaking because these monks, Benedictine monks, at the same time started also reintroducing the cultivation of the vineyard in Chianti that had a little bit disappeared for some centuries after, between the Etruscans and the barbarian invasions. So they started again the cultivation of the vineyard, and the monks have been there until 1804. That is when Napoleone Bonaparte came and he threw them out of the place. And then in 1846, it was bought by my family. So it's there's a very nice, interesting continuity for on the property for what was happening at the times of the monks and now and today.
So viticulture in this region stretches back to the Etruscan era.
Yes, yes. In fact, we have also always on the property there is a little Etruscan site. It's an excavation. And in fact, just this last year in June, during the excavation, they were going deep down into a well. Some grape seeds have come out. So we are now looking into finding out the DNA of those grape seeds and seeing, you know, the connection with today's cultivation. That was dated 2,000 years ago.
That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. So it's quite fun, yes.
And then the monks, how would you say that they affected the estate? It looks like an abbey when you look at it. What did they do in the area? How did they affect viticulture in the region?
Well, probably the most important thing, together with the fact that they started viticulture, it is that they also created a system of sharecropping.
I see.
It was really created by the monks, and which has functioned. It has worked so many years, centuries, in fact. And it is, you know, dividing the property into smaller entities. Every portion would be holding a house, and the house would be, you know, the house for a family, normally three generations together at least, so 20 people living there. And then together around all the ground was enough to cultivate enough for that family, and half of it would go to the owners of the land. And this is a system that has worked in Tuscany brilliantly until after the war, the 50s, 60s. At that time, it sort of, you know, there was a different economy coming up and industry and all that. So a lot of peasants has started living and sort of, you know, looking for more. Because it was a decent living. And probably, you know, especially in the last times, not hunger, but still there was not a possibility of making money. So it was... And that is the reason why a lot of people left. And that is also the reason why a lot of new people came in, you know, and these properties have become wineries, bigger, smaller. And Coltivuono was there and remained the same.
Because a lot of times when people think about Tuscany, they think about smaller boutique operations that happened since the 70s or so.
Yes.
But you're sort of the opposite of that. You've been there for
We've been
a
there
long
since long time and since before, yes. Yep.
And what was the extent of the estate under the Benedictines? It seemed quite large.
It's still more or less the same because it is now 800 hectares of land, which would be around 2,000 acres. And most of it is woods. So the part that is in vineyard is 60 hectares. So
I see.
That will be
15,000 acres. It's about 140 acres,
yes.
I think, something like that.
Yeah. So that's a much smaller portion. Most of it is still woods, forest, and very beautiful. It's more or less the same dimension as it was at the time of the monks.
And there's a, speaking of forests, there's a particularly old cypress tree. Is that true? It's like on a.
There are some old cypresses trees. The one you probably refer, it is a huge cedar of Lebanon,
Oh, the cedar,
which,
sorry.
yes,
I get my C's
huge,
confused.
very, very large, very beautiful, very attractive, which is just outside the monastery, in between the monastery and which is now the wine resort and the restaurant that we have there.
And that's in Gaiole.
It's the southern area of Chianti Classico, and it's the comune of Gaiole in Chianti, which is
But the vineyards are in Monti, is that true, or?
Monti is a subzone of Gaiole in Chianti.
Got it.
So it's a fraction of Gaiole in Chianti. And it's very hard in Chianti Classico to actually define the subzones because it is there's people that would then fear a sort of classification higher, lower, and
Sure.
so on. So there is a lot of resistance nowadays. But Monti in Chianti certainly is one of those areas that are quite compact and very good, very, very lovely production there.
How would you stylistically compare what comes from Monti, just not in qualitative terms, just style,
A
to
style.
Rada or Panzano? And what's the difference?
Probably more floral and more fruity, more generous in at the nose, the Monti style. I would definitely would say that. It's a little bit more southern. Rada's more elevated, so the style there is a bit different in that sense.
And you also have significant olive oil holdings,
Yes,
olive
very
trees.
important. What makes our olive oil quite well known is it was a very brilliant intuition of my father that already in the 60s and 70s he thought that olive oil was to be bottled and sold as wine, as precious. And before that, it was not really considered a sort of a precious item. So he started this separate operation just for the olive oil, and that has given us a nice start in this everywhere, but especially in this market, people loved it. And then with my mother coming in with her cooking class, that made it even more famous. And certainly the quality is very, very special, very quite unique because of where the olive trees are based. It is a sort of elevated area, very cold, and so less, not much crop, but the crop is very intensive. The flavor is really, really intense. And we've always been very careful in crushing so that we get the best fruit out of it, the best freshness. And so there was always a very high quality search also for the olive oil.
And let's speak a little bit about your family. Your family purchased the winery estate in 1846, and your relatives were related to the Salvapiana estate in Rufina. Is that true? Or?
Yes, that's true. The family that has purchased, it's called Giuntini, and that's my father. It's my father's great grandfather, and then my grandmother that was born Giuntini, she then married into Stucchi Prinetti. That's why we have this name. But the Giuntini is the same family that owns Salvapiana. And so we are cousins, and also close cousins in the sense that there has always been a link, an exchange between Servapiano and Coltibono. We are not distant. Rufina and the Chianti Hills, where we are positioned, they are quite close. So there's always been a lot of exchange between the two wineries.
And then your mother was Lorenzo de' Medici?
But my mother, Lorenza de' Medici, was her family. Coming from the major Florentine family, was very, very early in time sent down to Naples and was based in Naples on the mountain of the Vesuvio and in a little village called Ottaviano. So my mother's name is Lorenza de' Medici di Ottaviano. And then her grandfather moved from Ottaviano to Piemonte and Lombardy. So in fact, my mother considers herself very much a Milanese from Milano,
Oh, okay.
yes, in spite of her, long, beautiful Tuscan surname. She's a very Milanese into her way of being.
And she was very accomplished in her own right, as a writer and as a cookbook author and cooking school instructor. What was that like?
Oh, it was very probably surprising for her too, because when she was asked, she was before the major success with Italy, the Beautiful Cookbook that was published in late 80s. Before that, she was writing recipes for Italian magazines, and her style was trying to be very simple. And also, she also had an idea that, you know, she wanted to help Italian women to get a little bit out of the kitchen rather too much inside. So simple recipes and lots of recipes. And then she was proposed to do Italy the Beautiful Cookbook. And that was such a huge success. It was probably the first book that made Italian cooking so world famous, and also not cooking just, but also the culture. And so she became a sort of an ambassador. She was called everywhere, you know, her beautiful name, her also professionality in doing it. And that's how we started also the cooking classes at Coltibuono, and people started coming down and wanted to learn from her. And so in a few years, that place that was a little bit our private summer home became a one resort, where, as it is now, where we have hospitality, people come. And in fact, it's such a unique place and so beautiful that as a family, we decide we sort of get out of it and leave it to the community, because it's so valuable. You know, the culture that brings Coltibuono, it's so unique and important.
Because you have a sibling that runs a restaurant there. Yeah. There's a cooking school.
Yes.
Then there's the winery and
yes.
the olive oil.
Yes, yes, yes.
So it's a fairly big
it is
situation.
Fairly big.
There's a lot going on.
Oh, yes. It is a lot of, it's a big operation.
Agriturismo.
Yes, agriturismo, exactly. And the restaurant is even outside the agriturismo. The restaurant is available all time. So my brother Paolo is running the restaurant. And Roberto and I run the wine business and the agriturismo. And then there was a younger brother. He did a cooking school for some years, but he now moved to England.
So your mom was writing for Vogue, and mm-hmm. she was also on TV?
Yes, she was on TV on PBS here, mostly. She had a program that was called the De Medici Kitchen that was broadcasted very early 90s. And it was, that again, very successful. It has been sold all over the world. It has been seen in Japan, China, Australia, and she was invited everywhere. And very, very, she became very well known for that, yeah.
Well, the name Medici really rings so many bells with the history of Italy and culture. You know?
In fact, you know, when she was working for Vogue, Italian Vogue and Novità, at the beginning, she was signing Lorenza Stucchi. That was her American editor said, you know, would you mind using your maiden name? And so that's how she, of course, she agreed. It was interesting, you know, background.
And the estate today, in terms of wine, you have some other grapes, but you really focus in on Sangiovese.
Yes, yes. The whole concept for the wine, it is the same, you know, as for the agriturismo. It's like preserving this property with its heritage, and the heritage there is Sangiovese. So for that reason, we decided that we would not add or buy Sangiovese or other grapes from outside, but just sort of use, and we use only Marsal selection from our own Sangiovese. And also, we made in 2003 official organic officiality of our organic production, but we could say that we never really actually completely stopped being organic. We just, you know, we've always been there, because it is also another way to be very authentic. We try to convey something that is a very authentic style of Chianti that refers to the past. It's modern, but it hasn't changed too much from what it was in the past. We just modernized it without making it really different. And that is happening because we are cultivating that grape, and we are trying to, you know, to be careful to maintain a structure that was already in the past.
Because where others might blend Sangiovese with Merlot or Syrah or Cabernet, you've chosen not to.
No.
And you do a little Carignano sometimes, and you have a bottling with some Carignano and Colorino. But it's native grape varieties to the region, local grape varieties.
Exactly. We have another Chianti Classico that is more recent, where we have planted a whole lot of traditional grapes that were sort of losing favor, sort of those that they come in blending grapes. As you said, there is some black Malvasia, some Colorino, some Canaiolo, some Foglia Tonda, some Pugnitello, and all those are now growing also, and we are harvesting them and sort of watching out if something can move into being a single wine or not. But at the moment, they're all used as a blend for one of our Chianti Classicos, not the Badia Coltibuono, one that is called Cultus Boni, which is a little slightly different.
And when did you start the production of that wine?
The first harvest we came out was 2001. But in fact, the vineyard, that full vineyard, has started really producing since 2005, 2006. So now it is only with the most recent vintages that the formula is in, with the full, with all these little grapes coming in.
And then you also make a bottling that's all Sangiovese called Sangiovetto.
Yes.
And when did you start making that one?
That was a project that was started in 1979. And it started when our consulting winemaker, that is still today our consulting winemaker, Maurizio Castelli, he came over and decided that, you know, was in a way like sort of a mission for us, you know, to prove and show to the community how, you know, the potential of this grape, how beautiful it can be. And of course, it took a long time. You just, you know, you have to put a lot of attention in the vines, in the vineyards, and learn a lot about it, because before that it was never vinificated alone. So, but now I think it's a wonderful wine, and it is a project where we actually study the limits. So the Sangiovese is a wine that is produced in a total lack of oxygen. It's very calm. It stays on the lees for a really, really long time in a barrel. And that's, you know, where it is allowed to become itself and show what it is, and its potential, with a very, very slow making of it. And it's interesting. It's a wine that is it has followers that are really liking it very, very much.
And it's not made every year, is that true? Only in certain years?
That is because to make a wine like that, if you think that you're leaving the wine on its own lees and pips and everything for such a long time, you can only do it if it is the grapes are perfectly matured. If you just have a little problem or uncertainty, or, you know, green in a corner at the end of the pip, it will show up and it will make a disaster. So we only do it when really the grapes are in phenomenal state. And it is also, I think, you know, showing how well the Sangiovese can ripe in Monte in Chianti, how really nice the weather of Chianti Classico is for the Sangiovese. I don't think that kind of elegance can really show up in other areas of Tuscany. We are very lucky in that respect, because Chianti Classico really has an ideal climate for the Sangiovese grapes.
When you taste your wines versus other Sangiovese bottlings from other producers, what is it about the Missal selection vine material, or about Monte, or about how you handle it, that really stands out for you in the glass? What is it really summed up for you as?
It is. I think it has summed up to this very the fact that we could work on elegance rather than powerful wine, and so. It is the fact that we are working around the acidity of Sangiovese. Sangiovese has this characteristic of acidity that is unique to Sangiovese, and it has to be respected. You cannot, I don't think it's fair to come out with a Chianti Classico wine that has not that central part of acidity. But then the type of tannins that they come out, they're very, very elegant and very, very, you know, they're fine. They're not big and rough, but they're very tight and very, very fine. And those that wrap up the Sangiovese. What we have done also is that we built the winery where we actually vinificate the wine, where everything happens on gravity. And this was probably the first winery in Italy that used this system. And that is extremely helpful, because the tannins now, they're so soft and round and cultivating, that they are helping, you know, the global experience of the wine. And a third thing is the minerality. When you taste the wine, the combination of acidity and minerality makes your mouth really water a little bit, you know, wanting food. So it's very playful with food. So together, it's elegant, a lot of very generous nose, very nice and floral nose, and this nice acidity which kicks in, but gently. It's not aggressive. It's just a playful acidity. So I think that is the result also, you know, of the type of terroir we have at Monte, with the type of soil, and it's quite typical of that area, I think.
And you tend to use larger casks in general, mm-hmm. for French oak,
yeah.
by
yeah.
Cooper in Austria.
So. Yes, in Austria also. Yes, we also like to use Austrian oak because we think you have to be very, very light-handed with oak and Sangiovese. It's easy to cover it up, exceed, and that's not what we like to. We like to sustain the wine, but not, you know, just make it a little, give it a little bit of togetherness, but not showing too much the wood. So larger cask, which have always been used historically, they're still proved today to be the most ideal way.
I mean, it must be interesting to be at an estate for 150 years in the family, to have it, the actual physical surroundings date back to the Etruscans, and to see over since, say, the 1970s, rapid change in Tuscan wine in general outside of your own estate. How would you compare what's happening kind of beyond your property with what happens in Tuscany broadly?
Yeah. Well, you know, Tuscany is such a beautiful wine-growing area. We're so fortunate there because the combination of climate and soil is so perfect for many, many wines. So it's certainly very nice to see that Tuscany has, and, you know, tourism and all that, it's such a, it draws so much attention. So that's very, very nice. What I like is to really be very loyal to the tradition. So there is, and in Chianti Classico, there is a true tradition. If you come onto the coast, I don't mind, you know, using other grapes and experimenting other things because there was not such a tradition for fine wine. But Chianti Classico always had a tradition for fine wine. Chianti Classico was, you know, the denomination that has 300 years of history. So there is an history there, and it's very interesting to respect it and to promote it. And it's difficult at the same time because, you know, there is excitement coming from other areas and bigger wines, a little bit more international in style. And so we're still there with our old. But the thing, the whole project for me was to become exciting with Chianti Classico. And the excitement there is really explaining the authenticity and the unicity of the place, not sort of fooling around and trying to be like others, but really to be very specific to that, only to that little place. And I think that's interesting for people that, you know, like love wines. It's more about finding the diversity rather than looking for the same taste everywhere.
And how have you found that your own wines age? I know you make Chianti Classico, you make Reserva, you have the Sangiovese, as we spoke about. But in general, when do you drink your own wines?
I think a perfect timing for the wines, it's especially for a Reserva wine, would be 10 years. And even for Sangiovese, it's at the beginning, the wines are very, very pleasant. But in fact, you do not experiment that when after years, the tannins start loosening up a little bit and they become a little bit more creamier. So you lose that fake impression. It's not a real impression. Sometimes people think Sangiovese is a dry grape. It's not a dry. It's just, you know, it's just a combination, and it's like an effect of opening up and spreading around your mouth and your palate, and then kind of disappearing. But still, there is a back taste that still will be there. But it's like a tight and long back taste. It's not really wide and open. And that's that more wide experience. It comes with long aging. 10 years, 10 to 20. Then our property, we're very lucky because we have a collection of historical, we call them historical vintages, that they back up to the 50s. We open up currently from 70s up, and they're fascinating for people that are interested in how wines age. They're really fascinating experience.
What do you think happens to Sangiovese as it gets older? I mean, just in terms of flavor, if we're talking about 30-year-old Sangiovese, what is it taste like? What would be analogous?
Well, it is of course, it sort of lightens. It gets a little lighter in terms of, you know, body, and the acidity tends to come up, and that happens. You know, it depends also from vintage to vintage.
Sure,
because the 70s still is very captivating and very, very nice. And sometimes even had bottles from the 50s. Of course, the nose is it's a little bit more predominant because of the experience of opening it and pouring it in a glass and leaving it there. I usually do not decant these older bottles. Either I double decant and put it very quickly back, but I like to decant it in the glass. I really like to enjoy the full experience of starting it with really nice and close, and then then experiencing within the next, you know, if it's a very old vintage from 70 and before, 20 minutes of life in the glass, maybe half an hour, will be it. Because it's not that after it will, the wine will be dead, but it will be less interesting. During that time, there will be an experience of very great, nice earth aromas and pep and more, you know, spices than, you know, of course, the wines that are not younger.
And I think we all have our kind of idea of classic Tuscan staple foods that we see in restaurants or that we might even make at home. But if you were to pair your wine with a dish that was not classic Tuscan food, what would it be? I mean, what would be the application to a place like New York where anything is available?
Can I be very, very sort of pushy?
Of course. Yeah, you can say whatever you like.
Very dairy. I have had one of the most touching experiences in my life was in Japan recently. That was two months ago. And it was paired in a traditional Japanese restaurant with a dish that was a sort of a, let's say, duck soup. But the soup had, the consistency of the broth was quite thick. And the duck was very, very, very elegant. And that has been one of the most incredible, sophisticated pairings ever occurred to me. And that was really something that sort of moved me into another world in a way. And, the acidity of the wine, it really is so playful that I just, you know, when it comes to Chianti Classico, with Riserva, Sangioveto, I'm a bit more picky and choosy, but with Chianti Classico, I don't mind going with all, even spicy foods, you know, even ethnic foods. It's really very, very friendly wine.
Because it's still on the fruit a little bit, because it's not aged for as long.
Yeah, yeah.
And so in terms of your winemaking with the enologist, does he consult for other estates that I might know about?
Oh, yes, yes. Maurizio Castelli is he's consulting for, one historical, it was Grattamacco.
Sure.
Yeah. So now the Grattamacco is owned by the same group that has also Montecucco. So he's a consultant for all that group.
Got it.
And he's always, even Grattamacco being in Bulgaria, he's always been centered on Sangiovese. Down in another lovely wine they do with Maurizio, it's with Boscarelli. But so Boscarelli is another historical, and then in Chianti Classico is Castellare, is another winery he's been consulting for a really, really long time. So he has good, you know, old customers that have been. I mean, he's been with us and Castellara since late 70s.
In a way, I could see the style in between the two, but Badia seems a little deeper than Castellari. Is that fair to say in terms of texture?
Deeper and more, a little bit more typical of Chianti Classico. But I think the one aspect I really appreciate of Maurizio Castelli is the fact that he is never showing his personality. He's always really working for the personality of the winery and the wines. And I think that's very important. He's also he's not someone that, you know, super known. He's sort of really stays, works behind and really works very, very, very intensively to bring out the typical characteristic of that single winery.
And he works with your brother, Roberto?
Yes. Well, yes, of course. But when it comes to blending, we all work together.
I see.
I really, because I, we have been... I have been soliciting the wines like, the Cultus Boni or even the new Vinsanto that is called Occhio di Pernice, which is it's a Vinsanto that is made out of Sangiovese grapes. So I've been, because, you know, I'm the one that is very much on the market. So I really see and perceive and bring home what is, and I absolutely have to be part of the blending. I have been for many years now.
So that's interesting that you guys decided to do a red Vinsanto, because you had been making a Malvasia Trebbiano Vinsanto, then you decided to make one all from Sangiovese.
Yes, yes.
What are the flavor differences beyond just the color? How are they different? How do you use them different?
It is because you really get the power and the complexity of Sangiovese, of course, showing in a total different way than it would show for, you know, in the red wines. But our Occhio di Pernice is always, as our Vin Santo, is always played on the elegant notes. So it's there is an acidity. It's not a very sweet, only sweet. It's always very balanced between sweetness and acidity. And it is the complexity of the Sangiovese is showing in that wine. How I would use it differently? I personally like to pair it with just a few walnuts, just a little piece of very, very old dry cheese. Not, you know, I don't like to put it with desserts, really, personally. I tend to like the opposition rather than, you know, going from sweet to sweet. So my suggestion usually is that a date or dry dates or and walnuts is fantastic and some very, very sharp and old cheese.
So we've seen that you've already mentioned a couple of additions that have happened with your generation at the Badia Cotobono in terms of the new Vinsanto and the new blend of the different grape varieties that are historical to the region. How else do you think things have changed within your own generation at the winery, or have they not?
Well, they have changed because we are the generation that has, in fact, built the winery, the winemaking facility. Because before, because of the sharecropping system, the wine was made in many different smaller wineries all through, you know, the property. That was until the 70s, and then in the 80s we started consolidating, but we didn't really have a real one unique place, and it was still in a village with some things happening a little bit scattered over. Different places, close but not. And it was our dream to be able to bring, you know, everything together. And the fact of making this winemaking facility where you can actually work on gravity, it was a huge project. I'm glad we did it in the 90s. And so now, it's, you know, it's sort of in the past already. and it's working so well. I mean, that and, you know, and really becoming strictly organic farming and also, you know, some different in the pruning system that we have introduced some 10 years ago. All that is slowly adding up to a quality that I think now today Badia Coltibono is showing the beginning of, you know, the next step. So now the quality is really there. It's really nice. It's really exciting. The wines are really very, very good. And consistently, I see that in tastings they come out. Professional tasters, they tend to recognize now Coltibono. You know, I'm very aware of what happens in Tuscany and Italy more than outside. But I see that there is a consistency. And I think from now on, we are going to bring it up to a further step of quality. And that's going to happen because, you know, the vineyards and all and experience and all that.
Because in the past, there were cellars at the Abbey facility, ancient cellars, but there wasn't a winemaking facility.
No,
I didn't put that together.
So it was really a magic that we were playing to putting together the wines, and we used some houses that were together in a little village near the vineyards. But a thing was inside, another thing is outside. It was very, very uncomfortable. Now everything is really state of the art. It's a beautiful. Place and the winemaking is so perfectly running, so perfectly. We've been, you know, working, and this is definitely our generation addition. Definitely.
And you also choose to use indigenous yeast, is that true?
See, well, you know, it's not even a choice. So nice, happy, and strong that they just kick in. They're just
the Tuscan kind,
yes,
huh?
The Tuscan kind. Plus, you know, they're respected with because of the organic farming. We are very interested in this. Indigenous yeasts, and because they're also obviously they're part of this unicity and you know character of our wines.
Well, I'm starting to get thirsty. I see that you brought a bottle of your wine. Maybe you could take us through what we have here.
Yeah, of course. We are having a bottle of Chianti Classico Riserva, which is what is on the market now. We're shifting soon to the 2008. So this is a 2007, which was a fantastic vintage, very, very classic. You know, in spite of the weather changes that are sort of occurring, and we are starting to deal with them, and yet we are quite lucky in the Chianti Classico area because it's not so brutal. The weather still, and the vineyard still resists. So this Riserva 07, I think it's a very nice indication, very classical indication of how a Riserva can taste. Just to make it clear, Riserva It's a choice in the vineyard. Some vineyards are dedicated for Riserva, Sangioveto, and Cultus Boni, so the top wines. And so there is a lesser crop, so there is more work in those vineyards. And then once the wine is brought into the winery after the vinification, the fermentation and all that, it will age to become a Riserva in the barrels for 2 years versus 1 year. So there is more, you know, that's why you choose grapes that have more aging potential. And but again, the result that we try to look is not an over exceedingly strong and powerful, but it's about elegance, it's about smoothness, it's about a certain quite unique mixture of elegance and also a little bit of hard character that is part of Chianti and its history. Chianti Classico was very isolated and difficult to. I mean, the wine is probably its best product because it's the only real product of very hard land, difficult to cultivate. So, 2007. Darker cherry than a Chianti Classico, that would be red cherry. This is a little darker. And also some darker fruits, wood, underwood, you know, like, which is something that I like. And would you say, does it go for you also a little bit towards some chocolate, or maybe it's not there, but sort of pushing
it
into darker?
It hints at that without getting it, it's you not, know, not milky.
Yeah, not, no, yeah. It's not.
Just nuance, I suppose.
Nuance.
To,
it's not about, you know, big, huge flavors and tastes coming. It's all more about enjoying the finesse and the elegance. And but yet, as I said, there is salivation, there is depth, and there is a nice aftertaste that keeps lingering on.
One of the things I really have that draws me to your wines is they don't play for bigger power often. Mm-hmm. You know, I felt like in Tuscany there over the last, say, two decades, or mm-hmm. there have been a lot of producers that mm-hmm. were rewarded critically for big, deep wines. And I felt that for whatever reason, you guys ignored that trend and you stayed with what you were doing, which mm-hmm. to me tastes more of the old way. Like, I've actually had Badia Cotabono from the 60s, and I see a stylistic line that runs through mm-hmm. them, even though you change wineries and such. It still tastes of what I might have with Salumi, mm-hmm. just a classic mm-hmm. wine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that's what draws me to them. I don't know what other people really like about them, but I find that draws me in. There's a kind of classic character mm-hmm. to it mm-hmm. that says Sangiovese without trying to be something else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How would you describe what Carignano brings to a blend like this?
You're thinking of Canaiolo, maybe?
Sorry, Canaiolo. Yes, sorry, sometimes I forget and I'm in France for a minute. I apologize.
Yeah.
Canaiolo.
Yeah. It's a little, it is in our Riserva, it's now like a 5%. So it's like more an homage to a tradition than a real. It's a sort of another fruitiness, another edge, a little fresh edge of fruit that comes in, and some coloring also. It is, you know, because we are not particularly concerned in coming out with, you know, very deep colors. I rather like to have the wine shine a lot of light. And so this wine is really more red ruby than anything else. So some of these grapes that come in, like the Canaiolo, Ciliegiolo, Colorino, all those are just also to help a little bit with color. So less about really the taste, but it's a bit more about adding a little hint of color, which is, as I say, it's not really, I really like this nice red ruby color, and I really like the shining of light in it. So it's, that's it, yeah.
And you also have a negociant business where you buy in grapes?
Yes. We have started this because we were lucky. We had more demand for what we could actually produce. So we thought it would be interesting to come out with wines that would be well made. It is a negociant that has, it's not an industry, it's still very artisanal. And in fact, those wines are purchased from other areas. There are so many still very small producers around Tuscany that they would not be able to have the dimension to even sell with their own label. So they're quite happy to be able to convey it. And, you know, with also Dr. Castelli, Maurizio, he goes around, consults, and, you know, we can sort of help out a little bit in the growing, and so we can get a good product. And, of course, it's a sort of a little more entry-level compared to Badia Coltibuono. Still, I think prices of Chianti Classico are still very interesting and appealing, but that line is a little lower. And so it's a way to approach people to come and learn about Coltibuono and then eventually come up to taste the Badia Coltibuono also. So far, we have not managed to be guaranteeing an organic line in those wines, but we are coming close. There is now some, we probably will be able to do it also for that Négociant line.
And that line is called Coltibuono.
Yeah, just so simply Coltibuono, yes. Because once you add Badia, it really becomes the place and it's the full name. Coltibuono, it means the good cultivation. So it's also, in a way, could be used by itself. It can be also a fantasy name.
And what do you see as the position of Chianti Classico in the world market? And you do travel a lot. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I feel like Chianti Classico is kind of ignored because it doesn't seem fancy enough in a way.
Yes, you're right.
What is your impression?
It is totally true. It's our main problem and concern is it's not considered fancy enough because people consider Brunello more fancy, but because those are smaller productions. But in what I'm trying to convey, and it takes a long, long time, but I won't stop, is that, you know, there's in top Chianti Classico wineries, there's a quality and an elegance that people really have to understand. And once they understand it and approach it, it's hard to deny it. So, as you say, exactly, you know, everybody really feels, you know, the urge for Chianti Classico. But when I can get them and they understand and have, you know, some interest and start tasting the wine, then I know that I have them because usually they're proving to be really very successful.
And if someone were to not know Chianti Classico well, I mean, I think we've all heard of Chianti, but if they didn't know the wines well, mm-hmm. and you were saying to them, yes, you should come visit Tuscany, what are other estates that you especially admire in that area where someone might better understand Chianti Classico mm-hmm. for having tasted them mm-hmm. as well as yours?
Well, you know, there's, of course, there's, you know, we have my very, very close neighbors. They're very, we have a very tight relationship and we work together a lot. So I'm talking of someone like San Giusto, Rentennano.
They're so nice. Those
yeah,
people.
And they're so people. Yes, exactly. And we are, they're like us, they've been there forever. So we're.
It's
really,
amazing that yeah. castle fortress.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Yes, absolutely.
And the Vinsanto yeah. room, yeah. like the attic.
Yes, yes, yes. So it's really old. Of course, I would suggest Selva Piana. That's not Chianti Classico. That's another area. That's Chianti Rufina. So it's another Chianti, but. And then, but also, you know, Riecine from Gaiole, it's also, and of course, you know, there's a group of wine producers from Panzano that is also very interesting. And I suggest these because we all work together in the organic program. We are, in fact, now trying to work with our neighbors in Monti, in Chianti, and to promote a sort of a district of organic farming for the whole area of Gaiole, trying to get everybody on board and become organic, all of them. So I think, you know, if you work with this kind, if you go and taste and find out about organic farmers in Chianti Classico, you'll be well off in understanding the style.
And that's in terms of maintenance of the vineyard lands, but mm-hmm. it seems that you're also involved with maintenance of the local roads.
Yes.
The white roads.
It is, you know, these properties, they're not just a local, it's not just only about wine, but it's wine within a historical context. So yes, the local dirt roads, white roads, because they, again, they're part of the diversity and the uniqueness of that place, the beauty. And I personally have a passion for biking. And so we have in Gaiole this very adventurous gathering of, it's called Eroica. It's bikers that they come on old historical bikes and they come and they just do this. You can choose if you want to go for a shorter program or a really long, very, very, very engaging. But it's a very fun meeting that happens every year in early October, and it's getting more and more popular. And all these people get on their own bikes and they go through these dirt roads and they get to know other areas of Tuscany that they're interesting and beautiful.
And there's a professional bike race that happens every year too?
The Eroica has also a professional part of it, yes, which is in May, June. The one that is happening in October, that's not professional. It's really for passionate. But, you know, there's more and more people are coming because it's a wonderful way to get to know Chianti and you know, experience.
Seems like it'd be
it.
Beautiful to bike through that area.
Oh, yes.
Especially
yes.
On like an old yeah. antique bike. That
yes.
sounds like a lot of
yes.
fun to me.
Yes.
But there's a problem with the roads declining and you need
well,
to...
Well, you know, it's living on a dirt road, it implies a little bit of... extra effort, you know, for your tires, and so not everybody is favorable, and so there's a lot of debate about them. But certainly not for the main roads, but for the side roads, it would be very important to just keep them, and not because you know everybody comes and want to rush back and forth just to go get out and lose them, because they are a unique character and then interesting also for the life of the, you know, the fact that. Being organic in Chianti Classico is so easy. It's also because there's so much wood. There's a sort of a natural balance of the whole area that is still there. And that's very important for the health of also of the single vineyard. So animals, everything comes into that.
So not monoculture, but...
Yeah, not monoculture.
Polyculture exactly. and having exactly. forests. And
perfectly.
Because
yes.
when I think of Tuscany, I often think of those beautiful trees
yes.
along the
oh,
roads.
Yes, yes, yes. Yes, very important.
But I've only briefly visited Tuscany, and you've known it for many, many decades and through your family history. And I just wonder if you might be willing to paint for me a picture of some of your memories of Tuscany over the years and how maybe it's changed or what you specifically remember from your younger days visiting and what it's like now and things that have really stood out for you about that region mm-hmm. as you've grown up. And you've traveled to other places, so you know it in context. But, I mean... What has really been special moments for you inside of Tuscany that define the place?
Well, you know, define the place is really this this incredible... Coltibono has an incredible personality on its own that is so attractive because you can really breathe all the centuries of history there. It's just so powerful that even, you know, after so many years of going and living there, and it still catches you. Then, for me, it's, as you say, forest, woods, you know, the whole mixture of things, animals, life of animals, night animals. And so it's, of course, seeing the vines, the viticulture has been important to me. But the most important was being able to run around. When I was young, it was very isolated. I said that before. It was far, remote, and nobody was coming there. And that was, in a way, thinking it, maybe back then I didn't notice, but now thinking of it, it was very, very, very attractive and fascinating. It allowed us to grow frame of mind that today I see for my kids is so different. They have so many solicitations. For us, it was, in a way, being bored was part of our growing up. But maybe in that being bored, you build up your own passions, your own attractions. So it was quite nice. I like that isolation. I have a little book that was written by my great grandfather, dedicated to his daughters, among which one was my grandmother. It's a very funny book, and it's called Intimate Life at Badia a Coltibuono. And it starts by saying, you know, dear daughters, and I really want to live in writing a little description of our days here. And it says quite early on, it says how we treasure the fact that this place is isolated and far away and remote from everything. And it can be so quiet and so out of the world. And so I appreciate that very, very much. But at the same time, I think, that in this world nowadays, sharing it with people that come and visit is so important. It's more important than keeping it secluded. I think that's something that makes all of us very, very proud. My one of my engines, because it is certainly it is a very intense life to go around and sell wines and represent, and certainly it's very engaging, but it is, you know, so beautiful, and I'm so proud of it. It's so rich. There is so much going on there, and people are always very, very open to understand and allow me, you know, they ask me, you know, as you are doing now. And I think it's such a gift, you know, to be able to.
There does seem to be something very special about Tuscany, because when I speak to customers in restaurants, it's about special moments they've had with wine in a place. Tuscany comes up more than any other place in the world, I think, in terms of, we were on holiday there,
yeah.
My wife and I, or maybe we hadn't gotten married yet, we went. They seem to carry with them that glow of the Tuscan sun for many decades.
Yeah.
I'd say the frequency that I hear that is much more than any other region in the world.
Because there is still a lot of authentic life going on there, especially, you know, maybe big cities is not big, but still Florence is certainly, it's different. But if you go out in the countryside, you really can taste and experience something that is still quite authentic. People there are very, they're keeping treasure there in heritage. You know, if I go and talk to local people in Gaiola about Japanese food, I've tried once. I just, now they're beginning to be interested, but they are so much more in favor of their own culture. And that is very interesting because, you know, it is very fast. This world is very fast. And of course, every time everybody cooks, you reinterpret it. Your recipes and things, so it's very easy to move away from, but it's interesting how some, you know, parts of Tuscany manage to keep the tradition there, revive it, being modern but not losing the past. I think that's important. You know, there is new places in the world where you can experiment and go, but there's places that have a sort of like a mission to keep holding a little bit back, which doesn't mean being conservative in a blind way. It's mean conservative in a contemporary way.
And what are your own memories, to bring it back to wine? What are your own memories with wine that really stand out for you, whether it be Tuscan or not? What is a moment that you really enjoyed when you were drinking a glass of wine?
I have started, you know, in my teenager times, the first memory, it was in 1970, which is going to date me. But it was one summer that I remember for the first time perceiving that there was an excitement about harvest. And that was striking to me, because before that I was not really so much aware, you know. Instead, I remember 1970, everybody was saying, oh, this is really nice, nice grapes, nice harvest. So that gave me a little point of interest. And then, you know, we were talking about San Giusto Rentennano,
sure.
With them. They were their own, practically them and you know, Sobroglio. We were their only neighbors. So especially with San Giusto, we'd go there and taste wines together.
Historically, they used to own Broglio, right? Their family.
Well, the family, they're the same families. They used to be part of the family. And then, you know, with sort of inheritance,
spread off.
They are based in San Giusto. But San Giusto had a very nice, also cultivar. We were, you know, moving from one place to the other, and we started tasting wines together. Maybe not very professionally at the beginning. It was just enjoying them, but
in that little shed at San Giusto, I like it there.
Yeah.
Emanuela Stucchi Brunetti, thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Well,
it's been very lovely to speak with you.
Same here. Thank you very, very much.
The exclusive sponsor of I'll Drink to That is 750, a powerful and easy-to-use online search tool for wholesale buyers of wine and spirits in New York and New Jersey. 750 incorporates over 80 distributor portfolios and a number of unique features that make the lives of buyers simpler and more productive. I'll Drink to That is recorded with the great assistance of executive producer Matt Ducker, and also with the great help of our guests and listeners. Thank you for joining us. You can catch us online, alldrinktothatpod.com, no apostrophe, alldrinktothatpod.com, or on Twitter at drinktothatpod. And you can find us on iTunes. You should subscribe. Tell us what you think in a review. Subscribe on iTunes. Thank you for listening.